no point in introducing people like Ron Arcully, and who are so well known around Hong Kong. I could reread you all the bodies and public service, his record of public service. You know about his role on EXCO and West Kowloon Cultural District Authority, the Legislative Council. He is really everywhere in this town, and frustratingly for us reporters, he's usually very, very discreet. I remember one off-the-record lunch trying to get him to tell me about what was really going on during the PCCW saga, and he said, "I can't possibly talk about that. I'm far too close to the family." And sure enough, he was a lawyer for Lee Ka-shing when he was taking over a company known as Hutchison Whampoa, I believe. But he has fortunately left a very thick briefcase under the table here today, and I'm hoping he's going to forget that on his way out. I do at least like to tell people something that they may not know about our guest speakers, and usually they let that slip just before our lunch starts. Ron has never spoken here at the FCC before, something I find pretty amazing given his public stature, but in some ways he is coming back to his spiritual and family roots because he is a member of the club. But you may not know that his father was a journalist for the South China Morning Post, and at the age of 17, like a lot of sons, Ron thought that maybe he'd follow his father into journalism. But his mother knew best and said, "No way are you dropping out to become a Cub reporter." Obviously, she made the right decision. Otherwise, he might be here introducing somebody else much more prominent to you today. Of course, Ron's going to be speaking in his capacity of Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing. Ron, thanks for coming to the FCC.
Thank you, Tom. I thought you were a little up close and personal in our sort of very brief conversation, but good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be here. As Tom has mentioned, I am a FCC virgin speaker, so I hope if you have any questions that you bear that in mind. What I wanted to do today was to offer some thoughts on the roles and challenges of stock exchanges, bearing in mind the financial crisis that the world has gone through in the past year and a half, 2 years. It really has been a roller coaster ride for financial markets, and few would have foreseen the severity of the downturn, and indeed the upswing that we experienced since March this year. Nevertheless, the recent events in Dubai have reminded us to be vigilant, and that as we are not really completely out of the woods yet, so really no one knows for sure what's really in store for us next year. And therefore, I hope you forgive me when I don't forecast the growth of stock markets next year, and obviously as chairman of the exchange, I can't even talk about either the exchange or the companies, just in case there's a misunderstanding. So I have another excuse not to answer questions relating to that. But recently, of course, there's been some expressions of concern about overvaluations and the possible asset bubble, etc., and all that. So today I really, as I said, offer some thoughts on the role of exchanges going forward after the financial crisis. A stock exchange, as all of you might appreciate, is really a central platform for companies, investors, and indeed the economy in a wider context. Companies can raise funds on stock exchange to expand their operations, do the initial listing, and indeed get liquidity, and even post-IPO capital raising. Importantly, a stock exchange serves to improve a company's operations, management, and corporate governance standards. It does so through listing and disclosure requirements, monitoring compliance, and regulatory action. A publicly listed company is also subject to media scrutiny, as well as scrutiny of its shareholders. And I think talking about media scrutiny, I think one of the few things that we don't recognize often enough in Hong Kong is that we have an amazingly active financial media, both print and electronic, both English and Chinese. And I'm proud to say that we're probably the only major international financial center that functions in two languages, and indeed have English and Chinese as the official languages. For investors, of course, the stock exchange offers them enhanced investment choices for their savings, and indeed a chance to earn returns. Investors can also benefit from the assurance that platforms through which they are investing uphold standards like fairness, transparency, efficiency, and orderly markets and the like. Trades are, of course, conducted on the exchange, meaning that the exchange actually act as the counterparty to each trade, so that if there's a default on the part of a buyer or a seller, the exchange actually steps in and makes sure that the trade does go through and sort out the problems, as it were, a little later. And of course, the more recent incident that we had was when Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy, and the exchange had to step in to settle the trades on that particular day. And I think, if I remember correctly, the trades were somewhere in the order of about 2.5-3 billion Hong Kong dollars, which is quite a lot of money. So we had to go into the market to buy shares to deliver to buyers, or to deliver cash to the sellers to receive the shares. For the economy as a whole, a stock market aids in the efficient allocation of resources, as I said, from investors to companies, but also in terms of companies, they either carry on being listed and do well and expand, and sometimes, and hopefully on the rare occasion, they might either run into trouble for one reason or another and eventually get delisted. So a stock market is extremely transparent and liquid, and indeed serves as a useful borrowing platform for not just individual or corporate investors, but for pension funds and the like. Additionally, the stock market itself generates employment opportunities for those associated with it, including intermediaries, related market professionals, and it also contributes to the government revenue through, for instance, stamp duty. And indeed, I think as far as Hong Kong is concerned, stamp duty at the exchange forms quite a sizable chunk of annual government recurrent expenditure. I think it's about 10 or 12%, something in that magnitude. So when you think about that, it's actually a painless tax that all of us directly or indirectly pay to the government. So regulated exchanges serves a variety of crucial roles. Their worth was demonstrated, of course, recently in the financial crisis. I think almost all exchanges, and certainly all the major exchanges, continued to function normally and remained open despite the turmoil, providing ongoing and transparent price discovery for financial assets, as well as much needed liquidity during the credit crunch. And in fact, since 2008, something in the order of about $10 trillion has been raised on stock exchanges globally. And in terms of something in the order of about $4 trillion injected by governments as part of stimulus packages throughout the world. So although there was great volatility in the listed stock prices in the crisis, buyers and sellers remained, unlike credit markets, stock markets did not freeze. And moreover, of course, during times of uncertainty, the combination of good risk management, transparency, fairness, and a reliable infrastructure and central counterparty services, which exchanges offer, is very conducive to market stability and indeed confidence. The value of stock exchange, of course, has since been recognized by governments around the world, and I think today, quite often you see a reasonably broad consensus of governments at the G20 level and then some to want to transfer some of the over-the-counter trades in derivatives to the regulated exchanges. But of course, there are different sets of challenge. You can transfer what I call standardized contracts to the regulated exchanges, but anything that's custom-made will be a bit of a challenge. And during the G20 leader meetings in Pittsburgh, you know, several months ago, the United States and of course the EU decided that they will go ahead and perhaps introduce regulations to try and encourage or to try and legislate for standardized product to be traded on exchange as opposed to off exchange. Apart from reducing counterparty risks, it also helps to limit systemic risks. And that was really, those words, systemic risks, was really the key to the concerns of the financial markets around the world, you know, in September 2008. And likewise, the concern about too big to fail in terms of, you know, what happened to some of our well-known financial institutions. And you saw one or two household names actually disappear, you know, from Wall Street, so to speak, and one or two still around, but still, you know, struggling to try and get themselves back full functioning, etc., and all that. At the Hong Kong Exchange, we, you know, continue to explore our platform as well as our central clearing facilities and how we as an exchange can contribute to limiting risks associated with private bilateral trades. And to this end, we constantly think about new product range, and one of it could be a flexible index option that we might introduce in the first quarter of next year. But obviously, any product that we do introduce requires regulatory approval from the Securities and Futures Commission here. We're also looking at, you know, things like flexible index option on Hang Seng Index and H-Shares Index and the like. And flexible option simply means that instead of having set dates for expiry, you can actually sort of, the two parties can actually perhaps have the freedom to negotiate that instead of expiring at the end of the month, it might expire in the middle of the month or the beginning of the month. There have also been concerns voiced internationally about the added risk of central party clearing, because, you know, one should not, you know, take that once you have central clearing that it is again risk-free. The risk management aspects, other than in the cash market or options market, et cetera, and all that, takes on quite a different dimension. And asking exchanges or other clearinghouses to take on this new role or this additional role would put them, you know, back into thinking what are the risk management mitigating measures that they need to take, what are the capital requirements, and so on and so forth. And, you know, is there an economic or commercial rationale to do that? So, you know, whilst there has been emphasis on transparency and the need for disclosure, it's not a given that this will be done, you know, with anytime soon. But obviously, where there is the political will, these issues need to be worked out, and indeed can be worked out. On a slightly different topic, the change of legislation in the EU and in the US in the past few years have reduced entry barriers and have indeed given rise to the proliferation of what we call alternative trading platforms. And these are, as it were, funded by institutional investors, allowing them to conduct transactions within the club, so to speak, and therefore bypassing regulated exchanges. Somehow or other, you know, that particular operation got the name Dark Pools. And by itself, the name Dark Pool really refers to buying and selling orders and doing deals that are not really transparent and are not available to the general public. So you belong to, you're a member of the Dark Pool and you can buy and sell with each other. They are typically run by broker-dealers and indeed large market makers looking to save on transaction costs and fees. And not, of course, to alert the broader market of impending deals which could affect a stock price, depending on the size, etc., and all that. The popularity of the off-exchange trading volumes have grown with the advance of technology, which enables powerful computers to conduct high-frequency algorithmic trading. Using algorithms, these computers place numerous large orders to buy and sell stocks within fractions of a second, both on exchange and off exchange platforms, to profit on the arbitrage on small price differences. In tandem with more money and more money being devoted to high frequency trading, the share market of dark pools have been rising. In the US, dark pools have grown from capturing 1.5% of the market to 12% of market trades in just under 5 years. In Europe, it's currently about 4% of market share. The rise of alternative platforms such as dark pools, of course, have implications for stock exchanges and how effectively they can serve investors, companies, and the broader economy. Because participants in these pools have access to information about trades that investors using publicly available quotes do not, this in effect creates a two-tiered market and means that the playing field is no longer level. The fair price discovery process is impeded because a portion of demand and supply for a stock is effectively concealed, meaning that the public, typically retail investors, may not have access to the best prices. These alternate platforms and new trading methods also mean that liquidity is increasingly getting fragmented, translating into diversion of volumes away from publicly traded exchanges. Whilst there's no denying that exchanges would, of course, like more business on their platforms, market fragmentation has implications beyond that affecting investors and listed companies. Smaller companies in particular may suffer as high-frequency traders tend to prefer larger and more liquid shares. This could affect a company's development potential. Increased market fragmentation not only affects effective price discovery, it also increases price volatility and may add to surveillance difficulties. Theoretically, dark pools create information advantage for their operators and their participants, which could be used in the public markets. As these platforms are largely unregulated, they could also be subject to trading irregularities. So the lack of regulation and transparency could result in the systemic risk that I mentioned. And indeed, I think to some extent, the woes that were felt by firms like Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and AIG might have been contributed to by the volume of trading through dark pools. But there are, of course, deeper issues that some of these new developments could bring up, including the increasing transactional nature of share trading. Arguably, when shares are held only for fractions of a second, it is no longer about participating in the ownership of a company or ensuring it is well run. The opaqueness of trading and its fragmentation have negative implications for effective corporate governance. Could the rise of these platforms set up by investment banks indicate a trend towards remutualization of stock exchanges? As you're probably aware, most stock exchanges around the world were set up initially as clubs. And as we modernized, they became companies that were limited by shares with public and indeed different stakeholders and shareholders. But as the bigger trading participants are getting together again to create their own networks, is this trend reversing? Complicating matters even further, some exchanges have decided to join the fray and team up with large institutions to set up their own dark pool. Whilst off-exchange trading is still in the early stages in Asia, making up a small percentage of the average daily turnover, in a globalized marketplace, we cannot afford to ignore the issues that arise. The World Federation of Exchanges has asked the G20 leaders to assure a level playing field for responsibilities assumed by all securities market order execution, and call for more uniform rules between exchange traded and the less regulated markets. Regulators in the EU and the US have been reviewing the activities and the rise of these dark pools and are considering strict measures to ensure a fair, stable trading environment. The International Organization of Securities Commission has also commenced a new project to examine the potential regulatory issues. We in Hong Kong, of course, continue to work with our regulator and our exchange counterparts internationally to monitor and to tackle these and other issues to strengthen the local financial system. Regulatory arbitrage, where one market has looser standards and rules than another, has to be avoided if we are to succeed in our efforts. And whilst regulation is important, exchanges cannot dismiss the changing environment in which we operate and the evolving demands of investors. Investors, especially institutional ones, are seeking better, faster, cheaper services for progressively more computerized methods of trading. We have to find ways to improve our platform and functionality to offer best execution to accommodate new trading strategies, but in a fair manner, whilst protecting investors and maintaining market integrity. We must also continue to seek to offer efficient pre- and post-trade services in order to stay competitive. Competition is not a new phenomenon, nor is it to be feared. For us in Hong Kong, there has also been voices about the challenges posed by mainland markets like those of Shenzhen and Shanghai. With the rise of China, its cities growing and receiving well-deserved attention. At the exchange, we welcome their rise and the enhanced prospect for all that they bring. In combination, Hong Kong and other Chinese cities can achieve better results than each on our own. Each market has a unique role to play, offering different strengths, and although it has been said before, China does have the capacity and need for more than one successful financial center. Competition between our cities is not for supremacy of one over the other. Rather, we believe it is complementary competition geared to enhance China's overall economic development and the country's contribution to the global economy. The exchange in Hong Kong will continue to work closely with our counterparts on the mainland to achieve this. Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome challenges and strengthen our markets and make them more effective and efficient. But we are concerned by those that increase systemic risks or disadvantage a certain segment of investors to the benefit of others. Market integrity and quality markets have always been the key focus of the exchange in Hong Kong and have been motivating forces behind all our endeavors. We strongly believe that it is not only by upholding our standards and maintaining orderly, informed, fair, reliable markets, despite the pressures we may face, that we can fully serve our purpose in a sustainable manner. But at the end of the day, We are all but platforms and need the support of market participants to be truly effective. The financial crisis has highlighted the value of exchanges and its importance in financial markets. Lessons that have arisen from our crisis should be learned and not forgotten. In the ever-changing world, we still continue to seek to strengthen our operation, products and services to fulfill our responsibilities to our stakeholders and to benefit investors, companies, and the broader economy. There will be further details on how we intend to do this in our strategic plan for the next 3 years, which will be announced sometime early next year. In the meantime, I look forward to your continued support of the exchange and indeed Hong Kong as to our way forward in these very challenging times. Thank you very much.
Ron, thanks very much. We have about 15 minutes for questions. A reminder, please just identify yourself when you do ask one. But let me start it off with dark pools, which occupied so much of your remarks. Singapore Exchange announced its intention to launch a dark pool earlier this year. It made no secret of the fact it intends to take volumes off Hong Kong. What can Hong Kong do? What should Hong Kong do?
Well, I think that's exactly the point that I was making when I spoke about dark pools, is that what we need to do is, we know how the functionality is today, but what we need to try and avoid is, you know, that dreaded systemic risk. And therefore, you know, in terms of Singapore, and I think the if I remember correctly, the announcement when made by the Singapore Exchange was also, you know, coupled with the fact that they will also do the clearing, the central clearing of the trades on the dark pool. There's also an issue of how to report the trades. It is not a universal rule today that all trades on dark pools are reported. And whether they are reported on a timely basis. Not infrequently, you will have trades reported at the end of the trading day, cumulatively, and sometimes on a net basis. So I think, you know, these are issues that, you know, we need to tackle, and it's not just an issue of Singapore or Hong Kong or indeed Asia, but I think our American and European friends are also looking into this. Because at the back of it all, you know, technology is technology, but at back of it all, you should not allow systemic risk to, you know, to have an opportunity to come back and, as it were, you know, bite us again like it did, you know, last year.
Keith, and then we'll go to the floor.
Just to follow up on dark pools, does the expansion of dark pools have the potential to erode government stamp duty revenues in Hong Kong to the extent that these trades are netted and also moving offshore? And then also, just as a separate question, do you have a view on whether or not the media should be allowed on analyst phone calls?
As far as the erosion or possible erosion of stamp duty, right now the system is very simple in Hong Kong. The exchange acts as the collector of stamp duty from the intermediaries, and indeed the exchange actually guarantees each participant, I think in a sum of about $200,000 vis-a-vis their stamp duty. So if there's a default on the part of an intermediary, an exchange participant, you know, we stand to pay whatever is outstanding to the government. So the government, for that, you know, 10% of public expenditure, doesn't actually spend a single cent to collect it. You know, it's all done by the exchange. Now, when you're talking about dark pools, the issue of stamp duty is not a universal one, because there are markets that do not have stamp duty. So, with those markets, government or public coffers don't actually lose anything. I think as far as some dark pools are concerned, they say that they will pay the stamp duty, be it on a gross or a net basis. They also say that insofar as the levy that is taken by the SFC and the exchange, that they will not pay for that. But, you know, that's only part of, that's the revenue side, you know, to what I call the three parties. But the other aspect, which is probably more important from a systemic risk point of view, is central party clearing. So if there's no clearing, you know, there is, in fact, a risk. And as you all know, it's just common sense that, you know, the chain or the membership is as strong as its weakest link. On analysts participating in phone calls or conference calls, I don't know that there is a universal practice, but I did receive just before lunch a copy of a letter that the club has written to the government about their concerns that listed issuers have interviews with analysts without the participation of media, be it on a live interview or be it on a conference call. I can see the reason behind the letter, and I think in terms of that issue, I'll definitely take it up at the exchange and see, you know, how we can come to terms with the request. I think you do, you know, give one or two outs in terms of the companies, i.e., if you have a one-to-one interview with an analyst, you believe that that should be an exception, and you know, in those circumstances, it is perhaps okay, you know, not to invite the media in. But it's a message that I've got very clear, and I'll definitely take it back to our listing department, and I think you have copied the SFC, so I'm pretty sure we'll raise the issue.
Are there any questions from the floor? In the back here, please.
Yes, George Long. I have a question about essentially short selling and how Hong Kong could enforce short selling regulations and other regulations like that, disclosure regulations, if trading moves offshore to Singapore or other centers. So if a dark pool happens, you will have trading in Hong Kong shares really outside of Hong Kong and perhaps even settling outside Hong Kong. So won't that make it very, very difficult for Hong Kong to enforce short selling regulations, inside trading regulations, if that really does happen?
I think the answer to your question in short is probably yes. But having said that, I think from what we see from the announcement that Singapore has made, that I don't think they are out to, how do I say, undermine the stability of the Hong Kong market. I think they are out to initially start a dark pool operation vis-a-vis Singapore listed shares, and perhaps if that is okay, then go on to, you know, shares in Japan, Australia, and then, you know, perhaps Hong Kong. Number two, I think as far as stamp duty is concerned, I think the announcement also mentioned that if any stamp duty is payable to any foreign governments, that they will undertake to pay that. And, you know, those of you that know Singapore know that, you know, when they do say something like this, you know, they will definitely stick to it. And I think apart from that, I think at the G20 level, I think the leaders now are really working as one. It's not very often that you see political leaders, the heads of government, have a common view, particularly in the financial markets, which by its nature is highly competitive. So I think coming back again to the issue of systemic risk, I don't think either Hong Kong or Singapore, or indeed any of the regional markets, would consciously do anything that will undermine that stability, because you know, we've had several rough patches over the past decade or two, and I don't think we want to do anything that's self-induced or, you know, bring somebody else down. It doesn't serve our purpose at all.
So a question in the back corner.
Hi, yeah, Darren Bowie from Bloomberg. Curly question, but the Rusal IPO, which we understand was delayed for like the third time now, I'm just wondering if the listing committee has communicated anything to you about that decision and what you can tell us about it.
There are several listing committee members here. I'm pretty sure they can't talk about it for a different reason that I can't talk about it. I can't talk about it because I haven't got a clue what's going on. So I'm afraid I can't actually answer your question.
In your opinion, Ron, should Roussel list here? Is this the type of company the Hong Kong Exchange wants to attract?
Tom, I really can't answer that because, you know, I haven't, I mean, other than the fact of you know, they're being in the aluminum business, you know, I haven't got a clue as to the financials or the scope of their business, except, I understand that, you know, they're a pretty big company with, you know, quite a large debt as well that they've just restructured.
Steve.
This one I've got to be careful about.
Oh, I was just going to help you not to maintain your non-controversial stance. I just wanted to ask you about a perception that is abroad, which is that there's two standards operating within the exchange as far as transparency and accountability is concerned, and that there is a lower standard being applied for mainland-controlled companies as opposed to locally-controlled companies. I mean, do you first of all accept that perception exists? And if so, is there anything that can be done about it?
So far as I'm aware, the standards are applied the same. Number two, I think, if I remember correctly, in the past, let's say 5 years or so, there have been one or two mainland companies that might have gotten themselves into trouble, or you know, either with themselves or with the exchange. As far as I'm aware, standards that we apply probably apply if there's an imbalance more strictly vis-a-vis the mainland companies than the non-mainland companies. I think one of the initial what I call the teething issues, and I'm going back 15 years, is that if a mainland company has a dual listing, both in Shanghai and Hong Kong, or Shenzhen and Hong Kong, the disclosure requirements could be different. The suspension of trading could be different because, I mean, if you look back at Hong Kong 15 years ago, if there were a rumor about a company, the stock exchange would suspend the share and then make inquiries of the company. And then we moved on to put the burden on the company to say that if there was a rumor, we don't suspend. We might call the company and say, you know, do you have any statement to make? And it's entirely up to the company to actually apply for a suspension if they thought it was right. The mainland company started off life, you know, where we were, i.e. suspend first and ask questions later. But recently, you know, they have in fact changed to our practice. So the gap, let's say, of suspension, you know, has disappeared. There's no longer any difference between what we do on a day-to-day basis as opposed to what Shanghai and Shenzhen does. We still haven't been able to reconcile our trading hours. We start at 10, they start at 9:30, and they go through lunch. I'm afraid we can't actually persuade our broking community that they should not have a two-hour lunch. And there is still, you know, the trading hour gap. But, you know, obviously, you know, it's a work in progress.
Speaking of the pesky listing committee members, Jamie Allen.
Jamie Allen, ACGA. Mr. Arcali, you concluded by saying that integrity and quality of the market was paramount, but you didn't actually talk a lot about that in your speech, at least as regards to disclosure, accountability, corporate governance. Can you enlighten us, what is the exchange doing to improve the quality of the Hong Kong market in this regard, and are you satisfied with its performance?
I think in terms of all the high standards that the Hong Kong Exchange function under today, you know, we have members like you on the listing committee who are a very broad cross-section of market practitioners, of professionals, be they accountant, lawyers, bankers, people on the buy side, sell side, And it's quite a large body that it's about 28 members, and we only have one representative on that from the board level, and that is the chief executive of the exchange. And I believe that through a lot of hard work by the listing committee over the years, that you know, Hong Kong is where it is in part today. And I think in terms of what you just mentioned about integrity, all of this is easy to speak, but I think what I would say to you in response is that if you look at Hong Kong as a stock market, where it is today compared to where we were 40 years ago or even 20 years ago in the 1987 when we had that crisis and what a mess we got ourselves into, the number of exchanges that exploded in the 70s and 80s and the failure of our clearinghouse and all that, the major overhaul that Hong Kong was put through, both in terms of the regulatory side, that is the Securities and Futures Commission, as well as the exchange, I think we've actually come quite a long way. But having said that, it wasn't a path that was completely trouble-free. In fact, we had serious bouts of volatility and major challenges.
Do you think the listing committee has too much power? That it should be changed in any way?
Well, the listing committee doesn't think it has too much powers. I would like to think that I think the balance is there right now. I think my only response to that is to say that at the board level, over the past several years, we were, slightly uneasy that there might have been issues that were going through public consultation process that we did not actually give a view either to the market or indeed to the SFC. We have sort of religiously sort of adhered to that because we've left it up to the listing committee. We had a review of the entire operation of the exchange, including the listing committee. And I mean, right now the only input the board has is if there's a series of appeals, be it on an IPO or on a disciplinary issue regarding market participants, or when a listed issuer makes a transgression that they are taken, or that when they are delisted, there is an appeal provision that goes all the way to the chairman and two other board members of the exchange. And I think over a ruling that the listing committee did and the listing review committee, which is the other part, the other half of the listing committee doing a review of its own work, and then at the listing appeal committee level, it was subject to a court case that went all the way up to the court of final appeal, but that was in respect of a delisting, which I think all three committees agreed should be delisted.
Take one last question from the floor over in the corner, please.
Robin Fox. I think Hong Kong is the only exchange developed well still to retain. What is different about the market in Hong Kong that it actually needs a listing committee in the form that it has and which it's had for since the exchanges were merged?
I think in part it's probably historical. And you probably find that, in terms of, one of the roles that the exchange play as a regulator of the companies that are listed on the exchange, other than regulating ourselves, we are the frontline regulator of all the issuers that are listed on the exchange other than ourselves. And that function is subject to, several what I call safeguards. Number one, the SFC does an annual audit on that work that is undertaken by the exchange to see whether we've performed okay, badly, or well. Number two, I think in terms of the appeal process, that I mentioned. But number three, which is not publicly known, the board of the exchange is actually required by law to allow public interest to override shareholder interests in the event of a conflict. And this is, you know, this was put in, not today, but was put in, you know, when the whole reform effort happened. And the company and the exchange was demutualized and went public. So there are safeguards that are in place. And I think the recent financial crisis has demonstrated that there is no one-size-fits-all, be it in terms of governance structure or be it in terms of market practices. Of course, the one-size-fits-all would really be things like, you know, disclosure in terms of accounting standards and things like that, which is, you know, now virtually universal.
Ron, thank you very much for coming to the club today, and we look forward to having you back on a more regular basis in future. Please join me in thanking Mr. Arcully.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And being a virgin speaker, you may not be aware of this tradition, but we do have a gift for you.
Oh.
This is an FCC briefcase, so you can leave the other one behind.
I don't mind. Much. I'll take my documents out. Thank you.
Take questions from the local media. A quick stand-up.
Let me have a look.
I think I have time because the next one I'm going to see is going to be a Russian magazine.
Oh, okay. Well.